Welcome to the debate. Today, we are engaging with a text that functions less like a standard political manifesto and, well, more like a diagnostic manual for a civilization in distress.
Yeah, it really is.
We are looking at The Grammar of Violence, Decoding the Background Program of Modern Power by Dr. Bechara Sathli. And the central question posed by this material is, I'll be honest, it's unsettling. It forces us to rethink how we interpret the news literally every single day. The question is this: are the recurring crises we face, you know, perpetual war, ecological collapse, financial volatility, are these just random accidents that we simply fail to manage? Or are they the inevitable, calculated outputs of a hidden, quote unquote, structural code embedded deep within our institutions?
Right. And it is a very provocative thesis, to say the least. The idea that we are running on a background program, specifically one that Dr. Sathli argues is fundamentally self-destructive, it's a compelling narrative. I mean, it almost reads like a techno-thriller where the machine has gone rogue. But I'm here to argue that what the text calls a hidden code, or a cancer logic, might just be the necessary, albeit messy, mechanics of survival in a highly competitive world. The author sees a pathology. I see the evolutionary friction of human progress. We have to be really careful about diagnosing the patient as terminal just because they have a fever.
And that is exactly the tension we need to explore today. I represent the author's stance that we are operating on a dualistic operating system that defines rationality as self-maximization, and that this code is leading us toward a systemic collapse.
And I represent the skeptic's view that dismantling these so-called structures of violence risks dissolving individual agency and essentially removing the security architectures like the state and the free market that actually keep chaos at bay. You can't just reboot civilization without risking a blue screen of death.
Well, let's open with the author's primary diagnosis, which is what he calls the fragmentation problem. Chapter 1 lays this out really clearly. We have a habit, a very ingrained habit, of treating modern crises as discrete, isolated events.
Mm-hmm.
We look at a war and say, oh, it's about a specific dictator or a border dispute. We look at a market crash and we blame a specific deregulation policy or a bad bet. We look at a climate disaster and call it a 100-year storm. But Sathli argues this is an optical illusion. He suggests these are all predictable outputs of a single architecture. If we don't, quote, see the code, we are merely treating symptoms while the disease progresses.
I mean, I see why that's an attractive intellectual framework. It organizes all this chaos into a neat, grand, unified theory of suffering. But let's be careful about over-patterning here. Sometimes a war is just a response to unprovoked aggression. Sometimes a market crash is just a collective miscalculation. The text introduces this concept of the violence triangle: direct, structural, and cultural violence. My primary concern is that by broadening the definition of violence to include structures or culture, you dilute the meaning of the word until it effectively means nothing. If everything is violence, then nothing is violence.
I disagree fundamentally with that assessment. The violence triangle is the cornerstone of this entire argument. We fixate on the visible layer, right? Direct violence. The wars, the riots, the drone strikes. That's the spectacle. It dominates our screens.
Because it's urgent.
But the text argues that this is sustained by the two hidden layers: structural violence, which is the harm built into the system, like chronic poverty, poison in the water, or lack of access to life-saving medicine. And then cultural violence, which are the narratives, the flags, and the myth that make that structural harm feel right or inevitable. You can't stop the explosion at the top of the triangle if you just ignore the base.
Okay, but let's look at the actual utility of that distinction. Direct violence creates immediate visceral agony. It requires immediate forceful solutions: police, armies, sanctions. If someone is breaking down your door, you don't need a lecture on structural inequality. You need a lock and a guard. If we spend all our time deconstructing narratives or cultural violence, we might hesitate when actual protection is needed. The author attacks symbols, you know, flags, anthems, security doctrines, as tools of legitimation. I'd argue those are the social glue that allows a community to function and protect itself. If you strip away the myth, you don't get peace. You get fragmentation.
That brings us directly to our first core point of debate, which is the definition of harm. You're prioritizing the visible shock of direct violence, but the text makes a really rigorous case that structural violence is actually more destructive, precisely because it is chronic and normalized. Saheli compares a society with rare explosions to one with chronic deprivation, low life expectancy, exclusion from healthcare, ecological degradation. He asks, which is more violent? The one where 100 people die in a riot, or the one where 10,000 die quietly because the water infrastructure was privatized and neglected?
And my answer to that is that violence implies intent and agency. Structural violence relies on this concept of avoidable harm, which is incredibly subjective. If a market economy creates winners and losers, and the losers have less access to premium health care, is that violence? Or is it the price of an efficient system that overall generates wealth and innovation? If we label fiscal responsibility or market efficiency as violence, we are essentially criminalizing the basic mechanisms of modern society. You are conflating tragedy with violence.
But that is exactly the neutral face of harm the book describes in Chapter 3. The system appears procedural. It says, pay or do not receive. It looks rational. It looks completely impersonal. But the outcome is that people die preventably. It is slow violence without a villain. The text argues that because there's no one swinging a hammer, we just don't register it as injury. We accept it as, well, just how the market works. That acceptance is the ultimate success of the structural code. The code is literally designed to hide the blood on the spreadsheet.
It's not just acceptance, it's reality. Resources are finite. Allocating them via price is not violence, it's logistics. But let's move to how this is justified, because this is where the book gets psychological, and I think this is where the author makes some very bold, questionable claims about human nature, the moral coloring mechanism.
Yes, this is crucial. Chapter 4 explains how cultural violence acts as a filter. It turns red, which represents harm, into green, which is necessity or virtue. And this relies on what Saheli calls the dualistic template, or the DMA.
Right, the DMA, dualistic moral archetype. Good versus evil, us versus them, civilization versus barbarism.
Exactly. The text argues that this binary framing turns political conflict into an annihilation script. It creates a final battle narrative. If the enemy is capital E evil, then compromise is treason. If the conflict is existential, then total destruction of the other is the only rational path forward. This template makes de-escalation structurally impossible because it frames every conflict as Armageddon. We see this everywhere today: political polarization, international relations, even corporate competition.
I have to push back hard here. The DMA isn't some arbitrary script we can just rewrite or delete from a hard drive. It's evolutionary. It's deep in the mammalian brain. Binary framing, friend or enemy, is neurologically efficient. When you are under threat, you do not have time for nuance. You need to know who is with you and who is against you. In a crisis, people need moral certainty. The text proposes this alternative, the HDT. Remind me, what does that stand for again?
Holistic Dialectical Transcendent.
Right. Holistic Dialectical Transcendent. I mean, sure, that sounds beautiful in a graduate seminar room. See the conflict as a system, transform the tension, transcend the binary. But in the real world, the HDT feels weak. If you are facing an aggressor who is operating on the dualistic script, someone who wants to kill you, and you are trying to transcend the binary, you are going to be conquered. While one side is transcending, the other is reloading. Transcendence takes too long. Dualism offers immediate, necessary mobilization.
But that immediate mobilization is exactly what leads to the self-sealing loop the author warns about. If we meet dualism with dualism, we reinforce the very structure that created the conflict in the first place. The HDT isn't about passivity, it's about redesign. It's asking what larger system contains this conflict. It's about recognizing that total victory is a myth in a complex system. You mentioned reloading. The text argues that the DMA ensures the enemy always reloads, because annihilation is actually impossible in an interconnected world. You just create a vacuum for the next enemy. Look at the last 20 years of foreign policy. We crushed enemies only to have worse variants spring up from the rubble. That is the categorical failure of the dualistic script.
Maybe, but let's look at what actually drives this machine. The book shifts from psychology to economics in part 4, the ruling value code. This is where the argument moves from the abstract to the very concrete way we run our economies.
Correct. And this is where the diagnosis becomes terrifyingly precise. Chapter 7 posits that our current definition of rationality is self-maximization. We are taught, from Economics 101 all the way to the boardroom, that to be rational is to maximize utility, profit, or power for oneself or one's firm.
Which is the basis of the invisible hand. Individuals pursuing their own interests create aggregate prosperity. This is standard economic theory, and it works. It has generated more wealth and lifted more people out of poverty than any other system in human history.
The author argues it works like a cancer. This is the cancer logic of Chapter 8. A cancer cell is perfectly rational from the perspective of self-maximization. It optimizes for its own growth, it captures resources, it replicates, but it has absolutely no regard for the host, the organism. If our economic and political systems optimize for infinite growth, GDP, quarterly profit, without regard for the host, meaning the planet or social cohesion, we are structurally designed for suicide. The cell thrives, but the patient dies.
That metaphor is really heavy-handed. Growth is not a pathology. It is the engine of solution. Growth pulls people out of poverty. Growth funds the very technologies that solve ecological problems. To label the pursuit of prosperity as cancerous is to deeply misunderstand the nature of wealth creation. The system doesn't just extract, it produces. It creates value where there was none. A cancer cell only takes. A business, ideally, gives back in the form of goods and services.
It produces, yes, but what cost? The text highlights that the invisible hand fails when costs are externalized. We treat the environment as disposable means. The system selects for extraction. It's an evolutionary pressure within the market itself. Those who do not extract or those who internalize their pollution costs are outcompeted by those who don't. So, the cancer logic isn't about evil CEOs. It's about a selection pressure that rewards pathogenic growth. If you try to be a healthy cell in a cancerous system, you simply go out of business.
If that's true, the solution is targeted regulation, internalizing those costs through policy, not a total civilizational redesign. We don't need to burn down the factory. We just need to install filters on the smokestacks. But the author goes further than that. He links this economic veracity to the state security apparatus, and this is the part that I find most controversial, the idea of projection and the war state.
Chapter 9 is essential. It argues that states project their internal instability outward. When inequality rises and legitimacy falls at home, the system needs an external enemy to maintain cohesion. National security equals military power becomes a superstition. We genuinely believe that more weapons equal more safety.
Is it a superstition or is it just observation? The security dilemma is a real concept in international relations. It's not just psychological projection. If I disarm while my neighbor arms, I am vulnerable. The text talks about accusation as mirror, that we accuse enemies of what we are doing ourselves, but sometimes an enemy is just an enemy. If you ignore the reality of aggression, you don't get peace, you get the mirror concept, in reverse, you get shattered. The world is a dangerous place, and sometimes you need a big stick.
But look at the evidence the book presents on deterrence in Chapter 10. It calls deterrence a superstition because it relies on the assumption of perfect rationality under extreme stress. It works until it fails. And when it fails catastrophically. The text argues that national security has literally become national insecurity. We are building systems that can end a civilization in 45 minutes, and we are calling it safety. Furthermore, the war economy is exposed as an economic myth. We confuse destruction capacity with productive investment. We end up with perpetual war because the system is addicted to the inputs of the military paradigm. The contracts, the jobs, the technological drive.
I will concede that the military-industrial complex has its own inertia. President Eisenhower warned us about that in the 1950s. But the text seems to suggest we can just opt out of the security dilemma entirely. It suggests we can replace security through dominance with security through resilience. In a world of nuclear-armed states, that feels incredibly risky.
The dualistic script, for all its faults, provides a clear operational framework. It deters aggression through strength. If we start dismantling our shields because we want to be holistic, we are inviting predation.
And the text argues that strength, when defined as dominance, creates the very aggression it seeks to deter. It's a feedback loop. We build weapons, they build weapons. We feel less secure, we build more weapons. That is the definition of a system that can't learn. The author's point about just war is also devastating. He calls it moral laundering. We use ethical language to sanitize the outputs of a machine built for destruction. We say we are defending freedom or restoring order, but the actual physical output is rubble and orphans.
Calling it moral laundering is a very cynical way to view international law. Just war theory attempts to put brakes on the chaos. It's not perfect, but it's certainly better than total war. And this brings me to my fundamental issue with the book as a whole. It's a brilliant diagnosis, I'll give you that. He connects the dots between psychology, economics, and war in a way that is breathtaking. But the prescription, this massive shift to viability-first principles, is utopian.
I would argue it's the only pragmatism we have left.
Let me explain. The book asks us to move from self-maximization to life maximization, to rewrite the code from the dualistic template to the holistic one. But human beings are tribal. We are competitive. The structural view is intellectually fascinating, but functionally it might be completely paralyzing. We cannot simply rewrite the code of human nature or the international system without inviting massive chaos. The dualistic script provides the clarity needed to survive real threats. If we dismantle our defenses to transcend the conflict, we might not survive the transition. You're asking for a software update while the plane is in midair.
And here is the counterargument to that. The plane is already crashing. Survival defined by dominance is actually a path to extinction. That is the core of the viability argument in chapter 16. If we do not shift from self-maximization to viability first, where the primary design constraint is the health of the life support systems, meaning ecology, trust, public health, the system will correct itself through collapse. The code must be rewritten because the current code is mathematically incompatible with a finite planet. It's not utopian to ask that we stop sawing off the branch we are sitting on. It is the definition of sanity.
I suppose that is the ultimate gamble, isn't it? Do we trust the known imperfections of the current system, growth, deterrence, dualism, or do we risk everything on a complete institutional redesign? I tend to prefer the devil I know, because history shows pretty clearly that attempts to create pure new systems often lead to brand new horrors.
And the book concludes that we don't really have a choice anymore. The background program is becoming visible because it is breaking down. As Saheli writes in the epilogue, once seen cannot be unseen. We now know that our crises are outputs, not accidents. We can't pretend the machine is working smoothly anymore.
And on that, we can absolutely agree. Whether you believe the code can be safely rewritten or not, this material forces you to look at the background program running your reality. You really can't look at a news cycle the same way after reading this. You see the binaries, you see the externalized costs, you see the psychological projections.
Indeed. It demands we ask not who did this, but what system selected for this. And that is a question worth asking. Thank you for listening to The Debate.